First, let me express my appreciation to the professional societies for sponsoring these meetings and to the program committee for allowing me to participate. I'm a pilgrim among you. I usually go to the animal science meetings. The previous speakers have covered the basis of forage quality, and my assignment is to address the relevance of forage quality to beef production systems. And over the next few minutes, we'll explore the distribution of beef cattle throughout the United States. We'll look at the components that make up the national beef production chain, and we'll talk about how forage quality impacts beef production. Today, the U.S. beef production system has become heavily dependent on cereal grains, and we find ourselves in an unsustainable position. This statement comes from Steve Dameron's introduction to animal science and states that the purpose of beef cattle industry in the United States is to make use of resources that would otherwise go to wastage. And the ruminant animal has that unique ability to harvest and process fibrous, low-energy feedstuffs into a high-protein, vitamin-rich, energy-dense, powerful product. And we must take advantage of that. Cattle comes from the Latin word meaning capital, meaning wealth or property, and cattle were domesticated about 10,000 years ago. And why the cow and not other ruminant or species or grazers? Well, there's a PBS special called The Holy Cow, and they did a great job on describing how cows and man have partnered together, and they offered these criteria. Cattle were chosen because they're not too flighty. That is money, unless they come from Texas and some other thing. They're not too flighty. They grow at a good pace. They require a low maintenance diet. They breed in captivity, and they're not aggressive. Portions of this slide were borrowed from Gerald Horn, professor of animal science at Oklahoma State University, and some of the comments about the beef industry were taken from Larry Carr's 2008 centennial paper, Development of a Corn-Based Beef Industry. And the system, which this depicts where cattle flow from the cow-calf all the way up through the feedlot, began in post-World War II boom in the late 1940s. Up until that time, grass-fed beef dominated the market, and its production was widely distributed across the United States. And at the end of World War II, the inputs needed to increase corn production, that was hybrid seed and ammonium nitrate, and a growing demand for beef coincided to begin a steep linear increase in beef production and consumption, and we peaked in 1975 at 38 kilograms of beef consumed per person. Although total meat consumption would continue to increase from 81 kilograms in 1975 to over 100 kilograms per person in 2007, beef consumption actually declined from 38 kilograms down to 23 kilograms in 2007. Let's begin with the base of that chart with the factory that produces the basic component, the beef calf. And there are 750,000 farms that raise beef cows in the United States, and the U.S. beef population is about 31.7 million cows in 2008. That averages about 47 cows per farm. However, 10% of those farms, 75,000, produce 50% of the calves in the United States. Using dots to represent cows, we can show the distribution, and you may note some concentrated areas. Circle's not coming up very good there. There are 14 million cows, about 35% of the total U.S. beef population residing in the Plains states. And in our lab, we refer to this area as the grassland commons and anticipate that this area will be a more prominent role in beef cattle production in the near future, both in cow-calf units and in the post-production sequence as well. There's also another area of interest, which is in the Appalachian region. And this area can utilize beef cattle to use land that is unsuitable farming. Over 3 million, or 8% of the U.S. beef population, reside in that area. And this is a prime area for the production of forage-fed beef that can be marketed to the high-density metro areas and to individuals which have more disposable income. Together, these two areas account for 43% of the total beef cattle population in the United States. This slide shows the annual precipitation across the United States, and the amount of annual rainfall decreases dramatically as you move west. And once you cross the Mississippi, and really once you cross the 98th parallel, it drops off extremely fast. In journals of early surveyors going through the far west, this area was described as a sea of grass, a treeless, dry, inhospitable place. In the far west, as you go out into the Texas Panhandle and into Arizona, New Mexico, the thumb rule is one cow per section per inch of rain. So the varying of stocking rate can be from 4 hectares in the east to 23 hectares per cow in the west. So biomass production becomes almost as important as forage quality, and native plants are more predominant than introduced species because they persist. And grazing livestock are still the most efficient tool for harvesting, transporting, and processing forages that have low biomass density that cover a wide area. Back to the production chain. Majority of calves in the United States are born in the spring, they're weaned in the fall, they go through auctions, and they end up in stocker operations because the feeding capacity is limited and only about 20% of the cow-calf crop can go directly to the feedlot. The other 80% or four-fifths go through a stocker operation. And there are approximately 20,000 stocker producers, although the exact number is hard to ascertain because it is not something that we measure in marketing. The stocker component has four functions. Number one, it acts as a pool or an inventory management. As pen space becomes available, calves are drawn off of the farms or off of the pastures and into the feed yards for plate replacements. Two, the cost of gain in the stocker phase is 50% of that experienced in the feedlot. So if you can put 125 kilograms of gain on a 200 kilogram calf that you started with, you can dilute that high cost that you paid for the calf to begin with and hopefully make it profitable for the feeding industry. Number three, calves from different farms are assembled into truckload lots. These calves come from varying backgrounds and experiences, and the stocker phase is a lot like kindergarten. Calves are socialized, they are taught to drink from a trough and eat from an area, to be moved around, they're vaccinated, and so these are critical tools that are used when they make that transition in the feedlot area to make for less stressful event. And number four is the more gain that we can add during the stocker phase will reduce the amount of gain needed during the finishing phase and will reduce the amount that we invest in the final product. So calves across the southeastern United States are trucked to the southern Great Plains en route to the feedlots in the High Plains area. A very simplistic model of the production system is we start off with a 500-pound calf, which is weaned in the fall. Is transported to southern Great Plains, and then after 135 days or so of grazing, has consumed 3,000 pounds of forage, has gained 300 pounds, enters a feedlot weighing 800 pounds, adds another 400 pounds, and in the process consumes 2,400 pounds of corn when it reaches final target. Obviously, increasing forages would increase that amount that we had to invest. Forage quality would increase the amount of forage that weight we can put on during the foraging phase. If we look at when animals accumulate bone, fat, and muscle, we see that the three major body components are done accumulated at different rates. Bone is slowly but steadily amassed with time, but during the stocker phase, muscle is accumulated on a very rapid, more rapidly than fat. When we shift those animals to the feed yard, we do that at a time when fat accumulation starts to accelerate. We increase the energy level of that diet, and so we accumulate fat at an increasing rate until we hit the final market on the other, final product on the other end. Over 85% of the calves fed in the United States are fed in the High Plains region, which is in that circle right there. Approximately 10% of the feedlots in the United States feed most of the cattle, and the large concentration of feedlots in the High Plains pulled the beef processing industry from the Midwest to the High Plains. Now, Midwest corn producers now ship their corn to the High Plains to be fed to calves rather than feeding that corn to calves at home in the cold and wet winters of the Midwest. And once processed, the beef flows back across the Mississippi for consumption. There's not a major feeder or processor east of the Mississippi River. So that means those cattle have to traverse across the Mississippi, come out to the High Plains, and then they go back across. So once processed, beef flows back across the Mississippi for consumption, and what started out on 750,000 farms is now being processed by one of four wholesalers. So that comes to a high concentration very quickly. The final product has a lot of fuel miles in moving across the country. Our lab proposes the following shift in the production of beef cattle. More emphasis on the stocker phase to reduce the feedlot dependency on corn, which is diverted now to ethanol production, human consumption, or feedstuffs for other animals that are more efficient in converting starch to animal products. We just cannot compete with those particular species. And as an industry, we must take advantage of the ruminants' capabilities to convert forages to meat as opposed to starch. And this great pressure will be brought on not only for forage quality, but forage quantity and seasonal distribution. If we place more emphasis on gaining weight during the stocker phase, we're going to shift that line now in terms of body weight to my left, your right. And now we have created a situation where we have to have greater energy intake at that point in time in that calf's life to accumulate fat, which will place more pressure on forage quality. There's over 6 million hectares of winter wheat planted in the southern Great Plains, and winter wheat's a dual-purpose crop. It can provide forages for animals to graze and grain for human consumption, and winter wheat is a primary forage for stocker operations on the southern plains and supports millions of head of cattle on their way to the feed yards. Now, at El Reno, we are working with using perennial cousies and grasses, in this case fescue, as a combination with annual wheat, which is our key forage, to extend the grazing season. In this particular example, we used about 150 Angostura calves replaced on plots of fescue at a stocking rate of 12 head per hectare. They grazed those pastures for 29 days, and then they were moved to wheat pasture for 134 days, which is our typical wheat grazing season. Then they went back to the fescue pastures in late April, early May, for another 29-day grazing period at 7 head per hectare. So overall, we had extended the grazing season by 58 days. We increased the amount of weight gain we placed in those cattle by almost 50 kilograms. So we have now replaced part of that weight gain that was to be put on in the feed yard. We've done that during the stocker phase. You will note that the average daily gain in the fall on the fescue pasture is less than the average daily gain in the spring. And so perennial cousies and grasses used in this management strategy, and we use this strategy so that perennials will persist. Perennial cousies and grasses in the southern Great Plains cannot survive the droughty summers if we graze them for long periods of time. But by this intensive grazing for short periods with long rest, we're able to have these grasses persist. But still, if we use perennial coos seasons in this management strategies, we have to have higher forage quality and forage quantity in the fall to get more gain out of those particular grasses. The stocker calves we use at El Reno are made of different genetic material. Genetic selection for goodness of fit in the present grain-based system may not be suited as we shift to a forage-based system. In the beef industry, we selected for greater milk production, larger frame sizes, and a host of other production and phenotypical traits that have pushed the animal requirement much beyond the capacity of the forage-based system to meet. Consequently, we are required to buy supplemental nutrients. What we're going to have to do is a combination of animal selection to bring those requirements down. At the same time, the nutrients provided by the forage is upped to get them into balance so that we can no longer have to purchase supplemental feeds. Harvesting hay. To smooth out the variability, of course, of seasonal forage production, excess production in one season or year can be harvested and stored and fed when needed. And the ag engineers have done a great job of replacing human labor with fossil fuel horsepower and allowing one laborer to do the job of many very quickly. But there is a carbon cost to that harvesting forage. Now, this is rows of high moisture VMR sorghum sedan hay that we produce on the location to supplement our stocker calves during the winter and to fill in the gaps when forage production is lacking. And as we move in those transitions between forages, they don't transition seamlessly, and we have to have some harvested forages to get us through the gap. And this crop is planted for the sole purpose of producing hay, and we chose high moisture hay as a method to reduce field losses and the risk of rain damage. And the decision when to harvest a crop as hay is based on the class of livestock that you're going to use to support. So we have to balance the value of fossil fuel invested in harvesting, storing, and feeding with the value of that feed as a feedstuff. Stockpiling hay, stockpiling standing forage, swath hay, these are all options that can reduce harvesting costs because you're not actually baling it and moving it somewhere. But they are restricted in application to plant species and climatic conditions, and also to the class of beef cattle being fed. NIRS will become more prominent as a real-time analysis of forage quality in the field so that we can manage standing forage, when we can harvest it for hay, and also when we should graze it, and when we should provide small amounts of supplementation. This bar graph depicts the crude protein requirement of different classes of mature animals, A being a cow that's dry and pregnant, B a cow lactating and in the first third of gestation, C a cow at peak lactation, a first calf heifer, and then a mature bull gaining weight at a moderate rate. You can see the crude protein requirement varies from about 6 to about 11%, and the metabolizable energy from about 1.6 to about 2.4. If we look at forages that would use in these particular settings, the top group, you can see the crude protein level is such that it can match the nutrient needs of requirements of those animals if we match the animal's production requirement to the forage production timing. And that may mean changing the calving season or doing some other things. If you drop down to the coos season grasses, a lot of times they are in imbalances in terms of too much protein for the energy that's available. If we look at dry matter intake as a function of body weight, I show it in that first bar graph. As body weight increases, dry matter intake increases because it simply we can use a 2.5% or 3% as a factor. If we look at crude protein requirement, which is in the top bar graph, as the animal increases in body weight, the amount, which is the red lines, kilograms of crude protein per day, of course go up. But because intake is increasing at a faster rate than protein requirement, the density of the protein in the diet can actually go down. Energy, also the amount of energy needed goes up as body weight increases, and this is for an animal gaining at a constant rate of almost a kilogram a day. And as intake increases with body weight, it almost makes a straight line in terms of energy density. The effect of pharmaceuticals and technology on average daily gains are shown in this slide. Advances such as implants, ionophores, which decrease methane production predominantly, antimicrobial therapy, dewormers, fly control, all these technologies have positive effects on gain and have a positive effect on the break-even price as well. So we have to employ these technologies. I'm afraid if we pull those out and try to compensate by nutrients in the diets, that we won't be able to maintain those efficiencies. Well, I've been around the natural resource people quite a bit, but I still have to show data in a presentation. There's over 6 million hectares of winter wheat that are planted each year in the southern Great Plains, and we use a sizable amount of that is used for grazing and livestock. And although the energy density, as you'll see in the wheat forage composition, is enough to meet the requirements for an animal gaining almost a kilogram a day, you'll see that the protein requirement is half of what's in the plant. And as mentioned earlier, it's easy to get rid of the excess protein. You just pass it through the urine. But protein that are nitrogen that's excreted in the urine is more subject to volatilization and loss to the atmosphere. We conducted an experiment over 3 years to look at decreasing the amount of protein wasted. So over three production cycles, we compared limit grazing of winter wheat to normal ad libitum grazing. And we physically limited the amount of time cattle spend on pasture to half of their time. That's virtually one day on, one day off. And when they were off the pasture, they were provided a low crude protein diet of equal energy value to try to dilute out that high protein forage that they were consuming. Average daily gain during the winter when we were limit grazing was not different from the control group, although it approached it at the 0.13 level. And then when the cattle were grouped together and grazed a common wheat pasture in the spring, full-time, ad lib, because in the spring the crude protein level drops down to a more moderate level and we're not wasting protein, there was no difference in average daily gains. So overall production was not affected. However, we could run twice as many animals per unit of wheat pasture by limit grazing it because they were only achieving about 50% of their intake from that particular source. Summary and conclusions. Total beef cattle numbers will decline in the future, and points of production will be shifted. And this will be an economic factor as well as land use changes. Grazing period will be extended to decrease the amount of grain needed to reach finished body weights. In our production system, where we run about 1,000 stockers a year, we would be discounted 8 years, 5 years ago, if cattle were weighing more than 850 pounds. Now we routinely like for them to weigh 1,000 to 1,050 before they leave, because that's more gain on forages, less in the feed yard, which is more expensive. Beef cattle will have to compete for forage resources and land base. There are other resources that are going after it, biofuel, recreation, hunting, and we'll have to compete, and we may be shoved off to those marginal land bases, which will put more pressure on forage quality and forage quantity. And harvesting forages by grazing livestock must be shown to have a positive impact on the environment. I don't know if I'm just really sensitive to it or it's really happening, but I have seen several reports that have pointed to cattle and said they are a culprit. If you buy a hamburger, you're destroying the environment because they produce methane and they should be banned and we should remove them from the universe. There was an ad that had, which is more dangerous, a herd of cows or a pack of wolves? And the answer is a herd of cows because they produce methane and are destroying the environment. We must satisfy the social consciousness of our consumer that when they're buying a product, they're voting with their food dollars and they're supporting an industry that is environmentally conscious, and we have to be economically sustainable. If we're not, we can't be there to protect the resource. Thank you.
Okay, we got time for 4 or 5 questions. I want to do the first one, Bill. With the assessment of small grains and the nutritive value and having maybe, let's just say, twice as much, let's just say, protein as they might need, would you suggest that we either A, continue to use that in some ever inefficient manner that it has, or to have a management system as you proposed, or have a breeding program that reduces the protein of small grain?
Not to put the onus on the plant breeders, but why do we have to have that protein at that level? And see, the thing that got me thinking about this was having to buy ammonium or having to buy nitrogen fertilizer to grow 28% crude protein wheat forage, to feed it to an animal, and it only retain a portion of it, and the rest of it goes out the back end and volatilizes off. Why do I have to buy that year after year? I don't know if there's something in the plan in terms of its subsequent use for grain yield that it is storing or making those pools of nitrogen so that when it shifts from vegetative and produces a grain, it has to have that high level. That could be, and if you take that out, then you're going to destroy the grain production component at the other end.
It's easy for us, I think, to take the plant that we have, and because it's a dual-purpose plant, and have management strategies to efficiently utilize that in that plant, so the animal retains as much as possible. So in the short run, that's going to be what I would recommend. And whether the plant breeders can change that in the future, that's something I'm not privy to.
Money, I might comment that my understanding, I'm not a physiologist, but sometimes I pretend to be, my sense is that leaf end concentration is pretty highly correlated with photosynthesis rates. And so you start monkeying with that, and my guess is you're going to have some yield effect.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Annual, it's not a perennial, it's a C3, not a C4, so it's some leaf scenarios. Yeah. Other questions?
Bill, I see you're planting fescue outside the fescue belt, which is not against the law. It's not just inside the fescue belt for scratching our heads, but I take it it's a novel invite fescue.
Yes, it's a novel invite infected fescue. Yeah. And we also have other perennial grasses, Jose tall wheatgrass, Manska intermediate wheatgrass, Lynx smooth brome, and we've used those in these same grade study. The thing is finding one that will persist, and persistent is very important because of the high establishment cost. When we're looking at $75 an acre for seed cost, we're looking at a year deferment. That's a hard pill to swallow. There are watersheds. There's one in Kansas outside of Wichita, which is supporting agricultural practices in their watershed to maintain good water quality and quantity. And one of the things they're doing is they're supporting individuals that are shifting into perennial cool seasons during that deferment period, helping them get over that economic hump, because that perennial grass is better for their watershed than an annual grass where you're tilling and establishing every year. So that's a good point, and I'm glad you brought that up.
Okay, following up on that, why are you not using in Central Oklahoma the Indian grass and some of those other things that you can stockpile in the summer and graze in the fall?
Indian grass?
Yeah, and some of those other tall grasses that are already out there.
Because of crude protein on stockpiled either Indian grass or tall blue stem, even short blue stem, would be somewhere in the 6 or less by the time we stockpiled it. And as a nutritionist, I just can't see growing something all summer to let it go to straw. You know, I'm going to use it probably in an intensive early stocking in June and early July with a lot of stocker cattle, and I'm going to take that off, and then I'm going to use something else, try to stockpile. I could stockpile Bermuda grass, which is probably better than the natives if I wanted to do that. But I've just never been a real fan of stockpiling it. I'd as soon cut it when it's at its optimum, stored right there at the site where I'm going to feed it. And this high moisture hay has really helped us in terms of being able to, within 24 hours, cut a crop and have it wrapped, and my risk of rain damage really goes down.
Lynn, do you have a question?
What do you see as industry receptiveness to heavyweight stalker hens?
Would you repeat that question?
So what is the industry's perception to heavyweight stalker animals? Feeders, as you bring an animal into the feedlot, if it's too close to its final weight, they don't like that because they don't have a lot of margin to make their money. But they're still buying those cattle at an unprofitable rate. We're shipping cattle out at 1,000 pounds, bringing 95 cents a pound. They're going to feed them for maybe 100 days, and they're going to sell them at 82 cents. He already took a $13 rollback per 100 on the 1,000 he bought. That's $130. Then he's got to pay his feed bill. He's going to lose about $150 a head. And I can't understand why people keep paying that much for heavy stalkers, knowing they're going to lose that much. But they do. And so I'm not an economist, so I can't figure out.
There's a high demand for those heavier stalkers.
There's a high demand for them. Yeah, so the demand is there. And so if the demand is there, we're going to produce them. What's going to happen is this thing's going to come to some, once we have
fed up all the equity in cattle. Once people have lost all the money that they want to lose in cattle. And we burned all that up. Then it's going to come around to a profit-driven. This is what I can give for that heavy stocker and make a profit. And then the stocker producer is going to take that back and say to the cow-calf man, this is what I can give for that calf and make a profit. And so it's going to trickle back down. So we'll eventually get this market straightened out. But right now it is absolutely beyond reason.
Do you perceive that the industry is really going to be receptive to more of an intense forage utilization program? In other words, I mean, I've always looked at wheat, that whole thing got started, not because they started wheat to graze, but the wheat was for grain and this was nice. Now all of a sudden you're talking about putting forage in specifically, you know, for the purpose of growing beef. I mean, what are you seeing or what do you see down the road in terms of acceptance of that?
We're going to see that in those areas where people do not want to farm every year. They're tired of pulling iron and buying diesel. And so they're wanting to get into a lower input. And they may find that they can make as much money or more money in that kind of an operation as in an intensive farming operation where a lot of dollars are flowing through. And the volatility of that grain market has really got some of our people looking at, let's move, like we did from cotton to wheat back in the 50s. We moved out of cotton into wheat. I think we're going to be looking at going to grass. And grass may be in those marginal areas. We may be forced, we'll still grow grain on the very productive ground, but on the fragile, high erodible ground, I think we'll see what we're going to go to.
Any chance any lagoons are going to get into that?
Boy, we'd like to. I'd love to have a lagoon in there. Yeah, anything. And we can't really double crop, grow a lagoon in the summer because of our moisture limitations. So if we could have one that could be a companion, make a legumous sweet plant or something, I don't know. something that we could do would be great.
Bill, are there any efforts to graze more?
To what?
Why aren't they grazing more?
I mean, grazing more what?
If you're trying to cut costs, then don't do the harvest. And just graze the perennial.
Graze the perennial? Well, you've got your distribution. See, if we have to have a 190-day grazing season, we can't do that on perennials. We've only got a window of about 60 days into that perennials or 45 that they're really worth anything. So we have to hook together annuals, perennials, cool season, warm season if we're going to get 190 days. The feedlot has an advantage because it's a constant throughput. Cattle come in, the feed in the trough is consistent day after day after day. They are programmed and they'll be out of here in 185 days. Whereas in a forage system, you've got those ups and downs. So we have to, through either the weather predictions, climate change, harvested forages, we have to be able to consistently have that animal on a gain of, say, 2 pounds a day through the whole system to hit the target on the other end.
So one more question.
Is there any indication with all the pressure on cropland and grains and economics that the industry will ever accept a lower total fat in beef production in that final feedlot? With all of the changes that we're facing in agriculture and land and water and climate?
A lower fat.
And I applaud your recognition of the opportunity to increase forage, so maybe that's why I'm bold enough to ask you and the other scientists that question.
I produce what I can sell and maybe not what I want. There is a matrix and there is a target, which is a choice steer yield grade 2. That is zero discounts. I get a premium if they move into the prime grade. Can I afford to move that calf into that grade by feeding them 30, 45 days longer? What's the feed input? I have to figure that out. There is a discount for select, which is a little less fat than a choice. That's the target I hit because I can't afford to feed them into the choice. That's another 30 days of feed. And so probably my most economic target is a select yield grade 2, which is a fairly lean animal. But as long as you have demand for choice and prime carcasses and people are willing to pay for it, then you will produce it. It's not, I'm going to produce this and you're going to eat it because it's good for you. And you're going to like it and you're going to pay for it. That doesn't work. They plunk their money down and I produce what they want. So, but that's a good question.
As we thank Bill, let's thank the rest of the speakers that are here today.